Broadcasting in HD radio at 88.9 FM, this is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, and KBDH San Ardo, streaming live and podcasting at KUSP.org. Hey everybody, I'm Gary Shapiro, and it's time for From the Bookshelf. After the appearance of Superman in 1938, the comic book grew in popularity to become the most popular form of literature in America. By the 1950s, millions of comics were read by adults as well as children, and many fine artists and writers made their living creating the comics. Then, suddenly, overnight, those creators found themselves without a medium, and all those comics were piled up and burned. Why did it happen? That is the subject of David Hadou's The 10-Cent Plague, The Great Comic Book Scare, and How It Changed America. David Hadou was with us a few weeks ago, and we spent more than half the show discussing his previous book, the excellent Positively Fourth Street, a biography of Bob Dylan, Joan Baez, Mimi Fariña, and Richard Fariña. So I asked him to come back and talk some more about The 10-Cent Plague. David Hadou, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Here, thanks for having me back.
The cover of your book has this brilliant illustration by Charles Burns, in which there's this boy in a black and white 50s world, and he's reading some brightly colored garish comic books. And was that illustration you're doing or your publisher's doing?
A bit of each, mostly Burns is doing. My publisher and I knocked around some thoughts for the how to approach the cover. And for a while, we were thinking of something sedate, like a black and white image that would be journalistic to or repertorial to show that there are serious issues involved in what on a subject that's taken to be not so serious. And then we kept talking about it, and we thought that that didn't quite communicate the kind of the fire and the life and the excitement and the events that I tried to describe in the book. So we decided to go with the graphic artist, and we thought also a great artist who worked in the we ended up with it worked in the cartoon style would communicate the nature of the work at the heart of the book. But we wanted somebody who had a vintage style, somebody who was contemporary. There's no Charles Burns was perfect. So we gave my publisher sent Burns the manuscript. He saw the manuscript, liked it, and the notion of the cover was the visual idea of the cover was his, and I think it pretty neatly evokes some of the themes and the issues of the book. It gives abstract ideas, visual form. To me, that's very impressive, because I work in words. I don't work in images. And he found a way to show that, in some senses, the world. And I never. This is you're terrific. I really like talking to you because nobody asked me these things before. So I haven't talked about this at all before. In a sense, I argue in the. Well, I don't argue. I describe in the book that. In some ways, the world was black and white before these lurid comic books. And I mean, not literally black and white, but it was a world of the ideological extremes, and kind of it was a world of some where rigidity was kind of the norm in many ways. And comic books came along and rattled that whole way of thinking, and to a significant degree, comics brought color to the world of popular culture. So that's why we have in the cover a black and white scene, and the comics are what introduced color to it. Mm-hmm. And I also like the fact that it's a kid alone in his room, because kids took in comics. In an intimate way, and then kind of internalized the comics, and then took this aesthetic of the comics out into the world, and I think to largely change the world? That's a long-winded answer to a simple question. I'm sorry.
Well, no, I don't think it was a very simple question, because I think the cover, in some way, belies the tragic nature of the story that you're telling. Mm-hmm. You know, your book begins with Janice Valu. What is her name?
Mm-hmm. Valu.
Yeah, Valu. Mm-hmm. And she was this woman who was forced to abandon her career in art when the medium that she worked in was swept away as if she were a silent movie star after the jazz singer.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of a sad story, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, in a way, in some key ways, the book is essentially a tragedy. And we're talking now about the second meaning of the word plague in the title. Did we talk about that last time?
I don't remember.
I talk about this book. I'm talking about this book among my friends and my colleagues, and anybody who's down the street that will listen. And, I don't remember what I've told them. You know, my neighbors would have told you. I don't explain this anywhere, but I hope it's clear that the. When I talk about the 10-cent plague in the subtitle, I'm referring to two separate but related phenomena. One is the way that comic books were perceived by the conservative establishment in the mid-1940s when they started to become controversial and looked upon with skepticism by parents and adult authorities. They were thought of as a contagion, something that was insidious, that ran the risk of infecting the kids. And not literally, but you know what I mean. And then infecting the culture at large as a result. That's one meaning of plague. And then the other meaning of plague is what happened when this concern about comics on the part of adults grew to be a full-blown hysteria. That there was a clampdown on comics. It was a parallel to the clampdown on that took place in Hollywood during the McCarthy era, when there was when the HUAC hearings took place to investigate communist infiltration, so alleged or ostensible communist infiltration of Hollywood, a communist influence in Hollywood. It was a clampdown against comics, very much like the Hollywood blacklist, and the result was like a plague to comic book artists, and that's the sense in which this story is a tragedy. It tells the story of people, many of whom went to comics because they felt like their outlets were limited. They had few places to go to express their pride and outsiders. Status and the kind of wild ideas that they had. They felt welcome in comics, and comics were conduit for an expression of all sorts of outre ideas and unorthodox ideas. That's what rattled the establishment, and the comic book makers suffered pretty mightily as a result. There were hundreds of people who were driven out of work in the mid-1950s, many of whom were never published in comics again. Some took jobs in commercial art. Some weren't so lucky. They had styles that were just so unconventional or kooky or just purely comic booky that they couldn't find work anywhere else. There was an artist named Warren Broderick who became an ambulance driver. Another became a mailman. Another became a police dispatcher. And there were people like Janice Valu who were talking about who were so made to feel so embarrassed, came to feel, I shouldn't say made, I don't want to demonize, you know, the anti-comics folks, but came to feel so humiliated and embarrassed by working in this medium that she loved that she never could muster the nerve, the strength to even try to work in art again. She was humiliated. And
she kept it a secret from her children that she had once...
She kept it a secret from her own children. She had two kids. She had a house. She continued to paint, and she for herself, and she had paintings all around the house. Her kids grew up. Her daughter grew up reading Archie comics, and she never told her own daughter that she used to draw comics. And she was widely published at one time. She's not the only case like that. There were also comic book dealers who were arrested for selling comic books. But the real tragedy, I think, is these artists who were denied an outlet for a kind of expression that really didn't fit in anywhere else. So, you know, I'm glad. Anyway, but now we've ruined the end of the book.
Oh, no, I'm sorry about that. Well, I still think they should read it because I think it's one of the great creative nonfiction history books I've read, and so everybody should go out and read it right away. And we're just touching. We're just like... in fact, one of the great things that you mention in the book... Actually, before I get to that, I just want to say the other tragedy for me in the book is, as a person who loves comic books, is to hear about this thousands and thousands upon thousands of comics that were burned and destroyed. And it just breaks my heart.
Yeah, that was the extent to which the protests against comics reached kind of... I'm not saying that right, but hold on, let me back you. The protests against comic reached proportions that were really boggling, and were much more dramatic than I realized when I started working on the book. Like a lot of people, when I started the research, like you, being a comic book fan, I knew that there was some to do over comics, and I knew that there were there was a campaign against comics, but I didn't know that it was as broad as it was, and that it was dramatic as it was, and the communities organized public protests against comics and led kids into burnings of comic books, starting in December 1945, which is not long after World War II.
Yeah, so really. So from December, the Nazis to.
But December 1945, we're burning books in America, in schoolyards. And kids are encouraged by PTAs and parents to burn these books that many of them treasured, and they felt was something that was preciously their own. Now, not a lot of people may remember or know that the book burning, most of the book burnings in Nazi Germany were done on campuses by young people. They weren't adults or kind of goose-stepping, you know, soldiers burning these books. Like, you know, that's our image in the popular imagination. That's our image from, you know, Indiana Jones and the last, whatever, which of the Indiana Jones movies had the book burnings. They were mostly young people, mostly students who were led by adults to burn books, so that they became encourage that way of thinking by other young people, and that's the same thing happened in America just a couple months later with comic books. First book burnings that I could find took place in December 45. Then they continued for a period of 10 years. They continued straight through to 1955, and there were dozens of them all around the country, in rural areas, and suburbs, and poor areas, and affluent areas. A great many in the West Coast, but also in the Midwest rather, but also in the Northwest, in the South, the Northeast, Bridgeport, Connecticut, which is an affluent suburb. Rumson, New Jersey, organized the burning. It was canceled in the last minute, but the burning was organized. And dozens of burnings did take place all around the country. When I started to learn about this, I went back to the locations of the events. And many of the locations aren't intact, and many of the schools even have been razed over the years. But I went back to locations anyway, and then found the people, then kids, now, you know, grown men and women in their 60s for the most part, early 70s, who took part in these events, and I interviewed them. It's really fascinating. There was a kid, one-time kid, named David Mace, down in Spencer, West Virginia, whose mother had such pride in the fact that Mace had led the burning of comic books, that she saved all the newspaper and magazine clippings about the event and kept them in a cigar box and passed it on to Mace, who kept that cigar box for all these years. So I was able, from these materials, to I had some evidence of exactly, a record, I should say, of exactly what the kids said. They made a vow to never recite comics again, and in some cases they made incantations and they marched around the bonfires. Very, very frightening stuff.
Now, we're talking with David Hadoo, and his book is called The 10-Cent Plague, The Great Comic Book Scare and How It Changed America. A lot of the comic book creators were Jewish. Do you think that the people who were protesting comic books had that in mind? Was it an anti-Semitic? Was it what was it about comic books other than just the fact that they were low class? Or maybe that was it. What was it?
That's a very good question. I do think there was there was a strain of anti-Semitism in the anti-comics crusade. The comics were not just superhero comics, but the comics that followed during the mid-1940s, late 1940s and early 50s that were genre comics about, you know, crime and horror and lust and romance and sort of and all those comics, including superhero comics, to a significant degree portrayed a kind of pride in an outsider status, and had this notion that outsiders who might seem like monsters, and they were literal monsters in some cases, or might seem like aliens, and they were literal aliens in many cases, aren't malign. Hidden strengths. And this was, according to some of the artists who I talked to, and some of the writers who I talked to, kind of an expression of pride in Jewish identity. There are a couple books now written that argue, I didn't write them, a couple books now written that Superman is, you know, a symbol of Jewish identity. Of course, he's also a Christ figure, you know, the son of a benevolent, you know, father from lives in the heavens, you know, sends his only son down to do miraculous deeds for the good of mankind. So I think that there was a strain of anti-Semitism, certainly a strain of class bias, a bias against this kind of this form that people thought was illiterate and for people who weren't well educated, and above all, I think even more than those other two kinds of biases, a bias toward young people. And a distrust of young people on the part of adults. And I think that's really the cuts to the heart of the comics debate. It was, you know, young people and old people. And old people, I shouldn't say old, young people, and they were young. Most of those parents were younger than I am.
Right, but the generation gap is a
generation gap.
Well, when you say that the you know, your subtitle about the great comic book scare and how it changed America, in what way did it change America? In that way, or empowering the young people, or what?
Did you say I was just on the Colbert, I don't want to brag or anything, but I was on the Colbert Report the other day. Did you see this?
No.
Tell
us.
And he gave me a heck of a hard time about the notion that it is, that of course, typical for him, that America should change. You know, it shouldn't. It was pretty funny exchange.
I'll have to watch that on YouTube.
You know, it changed. Comics changed America in a number of ways, mainly by challenging the status quo and challenging the kind of the conservative orthodoxy of the early post-war period, and having a kind of wild and unruliness, and inducing a kind of and reveling in this unruliness. So there's a cynicism toward authority in all its forms, toward adult authority, toward parental authority, toward institutional authority, toward schools and the government, anything that represents authority, a kind of a reveling in bad behavior, and defiant behavior of all kinds, an absorption with violence and a conception of violence as play, prurience and absorption with lust and sex, and a kind of a cynical, snarky sense of humor. So, you know, in all those ways, comics were pretty radical in their time, especially radical among forms of expression for young people. And I think in all those ways they are the DNA of popular culture today. I mean, all those things I just described are infuse movies, great many of the movies in the multiplexes and the shows on TV, and it's the whole. I just described, you know, the whole sensibility of popular culture, and that wasn't the sensibility of popular culture. That wasn't these weren't the ideas that dominated entertainment made for young people prior to the explosion of comic books. So that's how, you know. Yeah, another thing is, I'm talking that there's something that's so obvious today that I haven't even said it. That's a key issue here, and that's that we think of popular culture and youth entertainment as one, you know.
Right.
But at one time, the culture wasn't fixed on youth and obsessed with youth the way it is now.
Well, it was a grown-up's world then, mm-hmm. and it's a kid's world now.
That's right.
Yeah.
And that's another, comic books were also influential in enacting that change.
I mean, the big entertainments that existed in the 1950s were adult entertainments, whereas today, the big entertainments like Indiana Jones and Spider-Man and mm-hmm. Hulk and Iron Man are all mm-hmm. drawn from comic book culture.
That's right. I mean, the world of it, there was always things made. There was always entertainment for kids. There was juvenile. There were always books and, you know, stories and even film. Not so many films, but there was always entertainment for young people. But it wasn't tended to be tame and to reinforce the prevailing idea that youth was a kind of pre-adulthood, and that the entertainment should reinforce adult values, not challenge adult values. And that's an idea that really came into full bloom with comic books that we take for granted now.
Well, another interesting sort of subtext in your book, R. Crumb appears briefly in the story, and he is taken with, because he felt that as he was growing up, he had just sort of missed this kind of era that you're writing about. And so he felt that because entertainment that was available to him was substandard, he was drawn to, he became nostalgic for a past that mm-hmm. was, that predated him.
That's right.
And in the 1960s then, there became a sort of a nostalgia boom, and Humphrey Bogart and the Marx Brothers and W.C. Fields posters decorated the rooms of teenagers.
Mm-hmm. I had that W.C. Fields poster, sure.
Yeah, but today, young people seem absolutely uninterested in the past. They don't, definitely not interested in anything that's in black and white.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think accounts for that? Does that...
The world is a mystery to me. It's not, and I think what's most interesting about this notion of yours, and I agree completely, is how we define the past today. Because you're talking about interest in the 30s that took place in the 60s, and now remember, yes, the Marx Brothers and W.C. Fields tended to be mostly the focus, and also Humphrey Bogart. The focus tended to be on figures from the past who were kind of photo hippies, or, you know,
ahead of their time. Yeah.
Proto-anarchists.
Yes.
They were anarchists.
Yeah.
So they were kind of proto-60s figures, outsiders. But that generation was utterly comfortable going back, you know, 30 years to find them. And one, I should add something, you know, this is all off the top of my, you know, we're going by the seat of our pants here.
Sure.
Although I have thought about these things. I think that it's not an accident that there was a 30, 40-year time period, because young people needed to find heroes who predated their parents. They had to be of a generation that predated their parents, so they weren't of their parents' generation.
Right.
So for those heroes to then be somehow a challenge to their parents and their parents' generation. So they had to be people who predated their parents' generation. But what I was thinking, what I were getting at a minute ago, is that our conception of the past now is, it's the one of not 30 years, 30 seconds.
Right,
you know,
right.
There's, we're all living in the, this has nothing to do with my book. Maybe I'll write another book about this. Maybe you should write this book. But I mean, everyone is connected at the moment.
Right.
I don't know what it means. I think all of our brains are being rewired. I do think something pretty significant is happening. I'd be fascinated to find what the effect on literature will be.
Well, I do think the end of your book is the beginning of your next 300-page book, and I hope it is anyway. The book is called The 10-Cent Plague, The Great Comic Book Scare and How It Changed America, and David Haydu is the author. David, thank you so much for coming back.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's always fun talking to you.
Thanks so much for joining us this week on From the Bookshelf. I'll be back next week with another great program. Thanks go out to our From the Bookshelf staff, Miss Breanne Beale, for all of her hard work. Thanks, Breanne. Check out our podcast page at kusp.org. For KUSP, I'm Gary Shapiro. Good night, everybody.